There's a bacteria in the soil called Mycobacterium vaccii, which actually increases your serotonin levels in your body.
Welcome to Psychologically Speaking with me, Leela Ainge. I'm a psychologist and coach exploring the way our beautiful minds work. In this new season, I'm working with a phrase that I've challenged my clients to embrace this year, which is expect the unexpected. And perhaps you've had an event or experience that did not go to plan. Perhaps there was something wonderful or serendipitous that came about as a result. I'm really intrigued and curious about what happens when life throws us a curveball, but also what happens when we let that happen. I'm delighted then to introduce my first guest of the season, which is Kendall Marie Platt, horticultural therapist and founder of Adventures with Flowers. Now, I've had several people nudge me to get Kendall on the podcast, and I think you are going to love the way that she blends horticultural therapy and sensory-led garden design. And in her own words, it's beauty that heals, rhythm that restores, and design that supports your body and your mind. You are so welcome to the Psychologically Speaking pod, Kendall, and thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to get into the science.
Let's do it. But before then, Adventures in Flowers, I think that is just such a wonderful business name. Tell me a little bit about how that came about and how you've ended up where you are.
My background is I was a forensic scientist. So I examined clothing and weapons for blood, other body fluids, and, you know, for violent and homicide crime cases. And I did that. That was kind of always my dream, actually, since I was young. And I loved it. It was very, very intense, as you can probably imagine. And for a really long time, I really enjoyed it. I got made redundant a couple of times, which had a big impact on my self-worth. I think anyone that's listening that's been made redundant can kind of understand where that comes from, even if it's like not your fault. Everyone was getting made redundant. They were closing the lab, but you still can't help but internalize it. So that, because then that meant that there were less jobs available, that then put, you know, quite a lot of pressure on me to get other jobs. So I worked for sort of four of the big forensic companies because I got made redundant a couple of times and kept having to move around. And that then meant, you know, my typical like type A brain, very high achieving, did really well in school, couple of degrees, all of those things, love to learn. But that meant that I basically was like, right, what can I possibly add onto my plate? And what can I possibly hold in order to prove that I can do this job, you know? So to try and improve my self-worth, I just started doing more, which I would imagine people can probably relate to. I think that's like the way our society works. Work hard in your job and you will be rewarded. But actually what I found was the only thing I ended up with was burnout. I still had to work. People expected me to be there. But around that time, I'd recently moved into the house that I live in now, and it had a garden. So I did that classic thing of adding the garden to my to-do list, you know, on the weekend, like, right, I'm going to do the garden. I had no idea what I was doing. But what I found was pretty much immediately, as soon as I went out there and started digging in the garden, for the first time probably ever in my life, my mind was quiet. So I've been diagnosed as ADHD. Obviously, I was completely unaware at the time that that not everybody's brains were constantly on and whirring. And it almost became like a drug for me. I was like, well, you know, if I go out into the garden, I can get this kind of headspace and this quiet, and this is amazing. And I'm finding loads of creative ideas are popping into my head and loads of amazing problem solving that I can use in the workplace or, you know, use in my life to make my life easier. And so I was very much self-taught, read all the books, consumed all the information. At the time, I didn't have children, so I had much more free time on my hands. I'd get in from work, I'd go out in the garden. It was my way of kind of like getting the stress of the day off of me. Of course, kids came along and I was like, well, how can I garden when I've got maybe 5 minutes, if I'm lucky, or maybe I've got 20 minutes in a nap time? How can I kind of be a bit clever with this? So I started to create what I call horticultural therapy activities. So at the time it was like, right, what can I possibly get done that's the right thing to do in the garden now and do it in a way that means if I've only got 5 minutes, how can I get that impact that I used to get from hours spent in the garden? How can I get that in 5 minutes? So it was very much a kind of like experiment. I was kind of bringing my forensic background in, like, what can I tweak and do? I just started to do that for my own practice, really. And I got to the point where I was like, right, I need to get this out there to other people, because I know I can't be the only one that would benefit from more time in nature. I was self-taught at gardening. I didn't really feel I could just go out there and be like, come and learn to garden with me to make you feel better. But when I was at university, I worked as a florist. So I started my business, Adventures with Flowers, with mindful Christmas wreath making. I'd spent hours making wreaths when I was doing the florist. So I put some classes up there and a few people came. I did that classic thing of like, well, I've created the thing now. Loads of people will book it. And then I was really disappointed. My mom and my auntie and like a couple of other people that I didn't know came, you know, set these huge lofty goals for myself, and then actually didn't really realize that I had to like put it out there and promote it and do all those kind of things. Started with the wreath making. And then as I got more confident in the gardening, I started doing some workshops in that. I set up a mindful gardening subscription box. I used to create the activities, send it out to the people with the plant or the bulbs or the seeds, and then they'd get that through their letterbox. And actually that transpired, that I set it up just as lockdown happened. The number of messages I would get from people saying, oh my god, your boxes have like absolutely saved me in lockdown, it's something to focus on. I loved the teaching side of that. I didn't enjoy the packing of the boxes, the ordering of the stuff. That me and my ADHD brain was very unappealing. Of course, would leave it to the last minute and then it would be stressful. And I was still working. I'd gone back to work by this point in forensics. So I was like, I actually want to focus on the teaching more. So I started then to lean more heavily on the workshops. I did a lot of online masterclasses because it was that time when everyone was logging on and learning new skills, weren't they? Because it was so then I started to incorporate one-to-one work as well. So people that were like, oh yeah, you know, the classes are great, but actually I really want your eyes on my garden because I'm really busy. Now I still to this day do a blend of everything. And I have what was the Mindful Gardening subscription box is now my horticultural therapy membership, which is on Substack. So I don't send the physical boxes out anymore. I just give the activities.
If we step back to the young Kendall who was a florist.
Yeah.
How old were you then? You said you were at university.
Yes, yeah, so 19, 20, that sort of age, yeah.
What do you think 19-year-old you would think about where you then took that? Was it like a Saturday job or like a part-time?
Yes, yeah. Saturday I went to Bath University, which is really sporty. And I wasn't particularly sporty. I just liked the town. I did used to do a lot of musical theatre, though. That was my jam. I used to do a lot of that. But when I, you know, those kind of rehearsals and stuff used to be in the evenings. And I was like, well, I want to earn some money because I love clothes and didn't want to be, you know, relying on my student loan to buy nice clothes. I could go and get a job in Topshop, but I thought to myself, if I'm really honest, if I've been out having a few beers on a Friday night, the last place I want to be is inside a sweaty, like, store. So in Bath, it's not there anymore, which breaks my heart a little bit, but there used to be outside the Podium shopping centre, there used to be a flower cart, one of those old carts that would get put up and set down every night. And I just sort of wandered, this is hilarious, I just wandered up to them one day and said, have you got any jobs going? And they were like, have you got any experience? And I was like, no, but like, I'm quite creative. I reckon I can give it a go. And they were like, okay, come for a trial, like next Saturday or whatever. So I went and I loved it and I was really creative. And, you know, I think at school, I very much was like pigeonholed into that you're a science bod. Like I did three sciences and maths for A-level. I was a geek, if you will. And I think, you know, we do that often, don't we, as we kind of silo people into the label because it makes us feel comfortable. But as people, we're much more multifaceted than that. So I feel really pleased and happy that, you know, my inner knowing, if you will, kind of pushed me in that direction. Yes, you're doing a science degree. I mean, I was doing molecular and cellular biology, for goodness sakes. It was a dry. And I think my body and my brain knew that I needed a bit of joy and colour and creativity in that, and also like interacting with people. Like, you know, I loved it. People would come and have a chat, you know, I'd get to know like regular customers who would like come and get their flowers every week. It was, you know, from a community point of view, it was much needed. Like, don't get me wrong, I had loads of mates at university, but they were all sort of, you know, young and in the same stage of life as me. And what I loved about that was that I got to meet people from all walks of life. So it was really great.
I'm going to come back to that thing around, you know, that analytical scientific brain and the creativity. But first of all, I think I've got an opposite problem. So I don't think my problem is, you know, that I don't have time to be in a garden. But I find that when I go into my garden, it's like a black hole of time. I can go into the garden and I don't come back out again. I kind of get stuck in there. I moved house. So just before lockdown, I inherited a mature garden and it's beautiful. But for such a long time, I felt this huge kind of responsibility to maintain something that was never really going to be what I wanted the garden to be. It's only really, I think, the last couple of years I've really stepped into the garden and I really enjoy creating my own space in it now. But that just means I go into the garden, I don't come back out again. So I have to have a plan.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's whether you don't know what you're doing in the garden or you've got so many things that need your attention. This is kind of true of life, right? If you've got a plan and you lessen your options as to what you need to do and you know that, you know, today, Tuesday at lunchtime, after lunch, you're going to go in the garden and you're going to prune your apple tree. You're going to go out there and you're going to do that. If you've got like four or five things and you just go out there with no plan, you're like, and it feels really calming to your system. And then it's not going to feel nourishing and restorative for you. A huge part of the work that I do is about getting people to, you know, sit down on a Sunday night while kids are watching TV. Everyone's kind of having a bit of a chill in the afternoon. And just go through your diary and think, right, look at my horticultural therapy activities. These are the things I could do this week. Right, what day am I going to do what? Really key as well. And it's interesting what you said there about the inheriting the garden and feeling like a sense of responsibility. That, I would say, is probably the vast number of my clients. They're like, oh, but the people before really loved this garden.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've got to kind of keep it as some sort of like weird homage to them. But actually, it's full of like loads of shrubs that I would never have chosen because I really want brightly coloured flowers. Let's get you feeling comfortable to actually dig out that plant that you don't like, you know? So you can make some really quick, simple changes to the way you feel about your garden by getting rid of these five things that you say don't light you up. If they're getting space in your space, They need to deliver. They need to like make you feel good inside. If you keep them in the garden, every time your sight goes to that thing, it's going to immediately drag your mood down.
I wonder what it is then. Because when we move house, a lot of us get really excited. I can make this space my own. We're really encouraged, aren't we, to be homemakers and to put our stamp on things. Yet when it comes to gardens, there's less of that. I feel like when you move into a house, nobody says to you, and also you have a permission to start again on your garden or rip it out. And I think it comes down to that identity. It's really difficult to step into somebody else's identity because, of course, it's not ours. But it's about us sometimes thinking, well, I wasn't given permission or I didn't give myself permission. And I think that's the real psychological work that's going on sometimes.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. People worry they don't know enough. And, you know, I still kill things like that. That happens, right? You know, you expect the unexpected. You cannot control everything. Like it just, that's what's the beauty of gardening.
Kendall, last year, we have this huge hydrangea and it just grows over the path every summer. It's beautiful, but it's too big. And so last year, I pruned it at the wrong time and got no flowers whatsoever. But I have just noticed it's budding. So I've not killed it. But yeah, you only learn by making mistakes, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, it's true. And actually, you know, with my hydrangea, I pruned my hydrangea at the right time. But because it was so dry last year, hydrangeas love water. And in order to produce the flower buds, they need lots of water. So I didn't get any flowers on my hydrangea either. So it was probably a little bit of a combination of both.
Yeah.
We struggle to allow ourselves to be beginners with these things. We think we've got to be the expert, which is where I think people get a bit unstuck with gardening because they research and research and research and research. And then they're like, oh God, now I just feel really overwhelmed. A large part of my work is like simplification. Let's just focus on this one area. You don't need to know like how and when to prune every plant in the garden. Like, let's not worry about that. It really is about taking that whole picture of the garden and kind of breaking it down into actionable steps, much like with any kind of goal or thing that you're trying to achieve.
I spent a significant amount of time last summer shifting pebbles from the front of the house to the back of the house to cover over a space that was just like a bit of a wasteland. We used obviously the space in a very different place. place and way to the people who lived in the house before. I'm intrigued then. So I've got an analytical brain. So science, obviously, is my thing. And I, before that, I was into business analytics and design, that kind of stuff. And when I came into psychology, it really met my need for analysis and deep dives and research. But I'm also hugely creative. So things like even having a podcast is my creative outlet, and I like writing. And so when you said there, you know, I'm both, and people do pigeonhole. How has that been for you?
Yeah, so I think that's a daily struggle, especially with the ADHD as well, because I crave the routine. I worry that if I don't have the routine, I'll forget to do the thing. But then the routine can feel restrictive as well. So what I tend to do is I will, on the Sunday, like I said, write in the diary the three things that I'm going to do, you know, that week. And I do put them in a day. But like today, I got up and it was snowing. So I was like, right, well, I'm not going to go out and start pruning my apple tree today in my 20 minutes. It's not good for the tree to prune when it's that cold. So I shifted the activity that I had planned for later in the week to today, which was going through my January and February seed boxes and like getting rid of the packs that are like, you know, knackered and need to go in the bin, and looking at what I've got and what I'm going to plan to sow. So I think it's really worthwhile putting those things down. And actually what I often do is in my digital diary, I just have 20 minutes in the garden on a repeat at 10:30 every working day that I have. That just repeats in my calendar because it's easy for me. It alerts me. So I'm like, right, get myself out of my like work thing and head downstairs. And then I've already pegged what kind of three or four things I'm doing in the garden that week. And then I can shift them around. So that kind of satisfied the structure and the creativity or the shifting about of things. So I don't feel like I'm too rigid.
Yeah.
Because I think I know myself very well now after however many years. And I know that actually if I start to feel restricted, you know, committing to regularly writing a Substack article every week, the minute I did it for a bit and then I just started to feel really overwhelmed by it because I felt like I'd boxed myself in. And then I just can't get my brain to do it at all. So it's frustrating, but a really good thing is accountability. Every week, actually plan with a friend. We get together on a Monday and we plan our entire week. So, you know, we know where we're at. And that is really useful for me. If I don't do it, I feel all at sea. So yeah, it is a juggle, definitely. I think so much of life is, but I think it's still a work in progress. You know, I'm finding and discovering things about myself all the time. I don't think we're ever really a complete article, are we? We're constantly
we're not in a fixed state either, are we?
Our own seasons, as someone who's just about to hit 40 and slowly feeling the stresses of perimenopause like extending their fingers into my brain and body, I know it's all going to change again. But I think the garden helps us to kind of have that fluidity, also that constant of like, it's going to be there, it's going to be growing, it's going to do certain things in different seasons. And I think that there's something quite comforting in that.
Expect the unexpected. I don't think 19-year-old you expected to be where you are now. And gardens deliver the unexpected all of the time. I think one of the most magical periods for me, for anyone who moves house, is that first whole calendar year in your new garden where you don't know what's going to come through and peek through. So I still have moments of joy, flowers that have had good years and bad years. Mm. So even for the first couple of years, things have done well. And even now, last year, some flowers did really well that I thought were end of life the year before. So I think gardens give us that element of the unexpected, which I think is really good for our curiosity. And it's psychologically really helpful because it kind of broadens our horizons. And we know that that's really good for us. So should we talk a little bit about why horticulture, why gardening is so therapeutic? And I mean, what do you take from this? What kind of evidence are you looking at the moment in terms of what it gives us?
Yeah, so I think for me, I've read all the studies and people say to me often, you know, oh, I love my garden, but they very often struggle to kind of quantify that or go beyond that. Oh, I love it. I feel good when I'm in it. But what I'm really interested in is like, okay, but why? Why do you feel good? What's happening in your body? Many of us are very disconnected from our bodies. And, you know, we are told when we're young, keep your emotions inside, don't show any big emotions, shove them down in. That's really damaging to us. We learn to kind of ignore our bodily sensations, you know, that feeling of nerves in our tummy. Oh, you're fine. Get on with it. Don't worry about it. Or, you know, that kind of flare of hot anger that comes. Well, you can't be angry, especially as a woman, you know, you mustn't show anger. So we deaden them and we just don't allow ourselves to even feel them. And my belief is that the reason what happens as we do that and we get to sort of, you know, this age, sort of like nearing 40 or sort of mid 30s, is that our bodies can't hold those feelings, those intense feelings anymore. And so it manifests in either anxiety. It leads to burnout, and because our bodies just weren't made to hold all of that emotion for such a long time, so it's very kind of somatic based. So I teach people is to focus on their senses. What does it feel like? What does it smell like? You know, that's very basic. We do that naturally as children, but as adults, very often we're like too busy onto the next thing. So it very often is getting people to pause, stop, and focus on their senses, and then allowing those feelings to surface, which for a lot of people is really scary, you know, if they've never felt comfortable in doing that. So the first part is really to kind of allow them to focus on those senses, to feel really safe, whether they're doing that on their own or whether they're doing that with me in the garden, to create that kind of safe environment in the garden. So what does it feel like? What is, because often I find people can't say I'm feeling anxious. They're like, oh, I've got like a bubbly tummy, or, you know, they can be a bit more literal with it, but they struggle to connect that then with anxiety. So often what comes up in sessions is that, you know, as we're gardening, and it's that kind of repetitive nature of the digging as they're weeding, or and the fact that their brain can quiet and not be thinking, oh, got to go to the doctors, got to, you know, do the food shop, all of those things that are buzzing around. When you're in the garden, those things can quiet. And that's what then allows the feelings inside to kind of actually come up and be held a bit more consciously in your body. And then, yeah, it's about kind of digging it out into the soil, getting rid of that anger or that stuck emotion. And then as we kind of create a bit more space inside of ourselves, when I trained as a horticultural therapist, I was like, right, I'm going to go do a course because I feel, as a scientist, I feel like I need that stamp of approval. I didn't really learn anything new. And I feel like I had some more kind of scientific things to bring to the fore. And so for me, it's been much more about, okay, so digging into more of why this works rather than that thing of like, oh yeah, it feels good to be in your garden. It's like, okay, but why? So my belief is it's because we can actually allow ourselves to feel our emotions and then start to reconnect with who we truly are. And that feels good. But I think people are not necessarily that conscious about it.
It's such a fascinating area. I think from a psychological perspective, environmental psychology has become quite a huge thing. And even, I think it was 2 years ago, the British Psychological Society created an environmental division. Mm. And certainly in the area of psychology that I study, which is social psychology, the idea of social prescribing or green prescribing, there's been quite a lot of research done on the benefits of coming together with other people to do things like walking in nature. We know intrinsically that doing things with other people and things that connect us to, you know, nature are quite helpful. We don't always understand in what particular ways. I'm very interested in studies that have shown that even just having that fingertip contact to soil brings around that benefit. And I read somewhere, and I couldn't find the study, but I read somewhere that if you put your fingers in soil once a week, that has a benefit of some kind. And it comes back to this idea that you're talking about connecting back with body and that kind of rhythm.
Yeah.
The attention thing, I think, is the thing that I probably appreciate the most about being in a garden, how you experience the world, whether you're drawn out of attention or into attention, into focus. This idea that gardening can really restore attention for us. Rather than our attention being taken by things, we allow our attention to drift, which is such a different thing, isn't it? It's not necessarily us being pulled out by an alert on social media or a ping on our phone. It's very much, oh, oh, I wonder what it would look like if I did this in my garden. Or actually, that's made me think, this bulb has made me think of something, you know.
No, we're not playful enough. We're so like, oh, must work to earn money to live. You know, there's no time for play and enjoyment. I just wanted to say the soil thing. There's two things I think in that. I know for sure that it's there's a bacteria in the soil called Mycobacterium vaccii, which actually increases your serotonin levels in your body.
So that's probably what it was talking about then.
Probably, yeah. And then for me personally, I feel like when I put my hands in the soil, and I haven't like studied this, but you probably heard about the term grounding. For me, when I put my hands in the soil, I almost feel like I'm almost like discharging all of that like excess energy that I've got in my body, you know, the pent up stuff. It's almost like it's kind of flowing out of me to be held by Mother Nature. I really like that analogy. I think, you know, as women, we hold too much.
Mm.
And actually, that is too much for us to hold. So if we can create a space that holds us, and, you know, you were talking about the environmental psychology element there. Is it a wonder that, is it surprising that if we look out on a blank, bland place that we don't feel joyful? No. If we look out in contrast on loads of brightly coloured flowers, you know, big blousy blooms or tall spires that are brightly coloured, and we get that little hit of joy as we do that, that dopamine hit, it's not surprising really then that, you know, our well-being scores increase, our stress levels reduce. So, and that's not even like doing it, that's just looking out on it. But for me, it's actually about the doing as well. So yes, it tracks, doesn't it, that we're in a nice environment, we feel better about ourselves. But actually,
they've tried to emulate that, haven't they, in hospitals and in nursing homes, and studies have shown, you know, that there are benefits there. And then I always think, you know, there's beauty in vastness and darkness as well. One of the researchers at Derby University is fascinated, and he does loads of research into the night sky. And obviously when you garden, light and dark is everything, because there's not much growth when it's dark. But he was really talking about, you know, how connected we and grounded we can feel when we look at the dark night sky without light pollution. And it was the way he talks about it, just kind of made me think about how you've just describe that grounding feeling and how we all get that from different things. I would say running's the thing that I feel most grounded in when I'm, if I need to, I suppose, transfer any energy I've got, excess energy, it's the running and hitting the floor and the crunch that would do that. But I think it's such a fascinating area. What was the name of that bacteria again?
Mycobacterium. And then vaccii, which is V-A-C-C-A-E, is a Latin.
I love that you know bacteria, and I've got a scientist on who can tell me what this magical thing in soil is, because I keep circling back to it, because I've got a half-written blog where I couldn't find the reference. So
there you go. My dissertation for my undergrad was all about like cultivating bacteria. I spent a lot of time digging around in bacteria. So I think those names always kind of, always stick with me.
The fact that you are a horticultural therapist, but the name you've chosen is Adventures. The thing for me that makes gardening so wonderful is that it doesn't feel clinical, is that that's what makes it so accessible. So I just love your business name.
So it's really interesting that the title of horticultural therapist, because I resisted using that for a long time because I felt like it felt too clinical. The adventures with flowers certainly came before, because that's what I felt I'd gone on, like a real adventure. Like, but it's really only in the last couple of years that I've really leaned into that horticultural therapist title. And I wanted to speak briefly about, you know, how you said a lot of horticultural therapy sessions happen in community gardens or physical locations that you can go to. And that has kind of been like the traditional way that you can access it. So social prescribing, you go to your doctor. You say, I'm feeling anxious. And instead of giving you pills or whatever other things, talking therapies, they will say to you, oh, we've got these options for social prescribing. One of them is gardening. And what happens is they basically prescribe you maybe 6 to 8 sessions in a horticultural community garden that you go to, and you do these sessions. And the reason I set up my business was because I was like, that doesn't work for the modern working woman. Who's got like 3 hours in the middle of the day on a Wednesday to go drive somewhere, go to the session, drive back 6 to 8 weeks in a row. Like, I don't know about you, but there's no way that I could do that. And so I was like, how can I get that, you know, the therapeutic elements from that and give that to women so they can do it on their lunch break at home, or they get back home from work in the evening, you know, not so much in the winter, obviously, or, you know, save those activities up for the weekend. The people that need it the most, in my personal view, are the women that are holding a lot. And those women will just struggle to, A, give themselves the time until they burn out, and then they're forced into it. My work is about prevention rather than cure. It's about taking that action before you get there. Because if you can restore yourself a little bit every day in the garden, 3 days, the research shows three times a week for 20 minutes at a time will increase your well-being scores by 6.6% and decrease your stress levels by 4.2%. A lot of the work I do is like linking it to another activity that you do. So it becomes like, oh, I finished my lunch, I'm going in the garden. Oh, I've got home from work, I'm going in the garden. But something that I really want to focus on this year is doing it in community. So how can I replicate that community element that you get in a garden setting where you're all there gardening together? How can I do that? So we have garden along sessions, I call them. And it sounds mental, but we all log onto our laptops or our phones and we prop them up in the garden and we set our intention at the beginning of the session. And we're like, this is what I want to get done. And then we garden for 20 minutes. And then, so at the start, we share sort of how we're feeling on a scale of 1 to 10, what's been going on for us. Then we garden. Then we share maybe what came up for us. If there were some feelings that came up, something like something we'd forgotten about that we actually really want to deal with in the next 20 minutes. So we do 3 20-minute blocks and then we come together at the end and we're like, right, how am I feeling on the scale of 1 to 10 now? Have I gone up? Has my mood increased? Has my anxiety dropped? You know, because for me, I can't help but want to see that as a quantifiable number. I know a lot of your research is done, you know, qualitatively and talking to people, which there is an element. But for me, and I think for a lot of my clients, they like that. Oh, I was a 4 and now I'm a 6, because I think they can really see the improvement then.
So that's really interesting. So the psychological basis of this idea of the social cure, and I know you said I'd rather be about the prevention than the cure, and I think that's where things have ended up. But the psychological basis of social cure really came from this idea that we know that group memberships can sustain us and improve our mental and physical health. And that comes from the social identity approach, and where I'm doing my research around women who use online memberships. So we know that when you are part of a membership and it sits with your idea or your own self-concept, it taps into this idea of social identity theory. So you've got a few different things happening there. And what you are developing by doing the gardening co-working almost, you know, you are enabling people to do that through proxy, but you're kind of cultivating that group piece. But this social identity piece is really important. The social cure is a massive strand of psychological research. You have this idea of self-categorization theory. How do I become us, or me becomes we? So you go from being an individual to that group or sense of group or community. That's a really interesting thing to consider when you think about how personal gardens are, what we want in our personal space. I'm just kind of riffing off this, but part of what you're creating then is mixing two things, is to say, I want to take people's individual fulfillment, but also provide them with something that's a group experience as well. Mm. And that, I suppose, is combining both the prevention, the individual practice, and spending time with the social cure bit, which is saying if we bring both of those, that really matters. Core idea really around social identity says that social support really does matter, but the shared identity matters more.
It's interesting because a lot of people say to me, oh, I'm not a gardener. And I'm like, you know what? You don't need to be a gardener, but you need to be garden curious. Some of them are already identifying potentially as a gardener, or they dabble in the garden, but they're a bit nervous to like coin that phrase. But yeah.
And that's the idea. That's the bit, isn't it? Yeah. That's the bit that you're providing. You're providing them that touch point with other people that are like them.
Yeah.
These are people like me. That's the culture in horticulture, if you like.
Facilitating that space. And that's something I'm really leaning into this year, is that, you know, that's where my magic is holding space for people. But I feel like, you know, I find it easy to do that in person, very easy. And the feedback I get consistently, you know, I've been doing those workshops now for 8 years, the wreath making and others. The feedback I get consistently is, you know, wow, you know, I felt so safe and able to, you know, big things come up. People talk about parents that are ill, a child that's having an issue at school. You know, these are women that I'm getting in a room together that, you know, have never met. And yet when we're doing the activity, because we're, you know, focusing on the thing that we're doing, we're kind of reducing that barrier of like, oh, but what will people think of me? And people feel able to talk more and vocalize, you know, what's going on for them.
Here's something to maybe think about then. So my original research looked at, you know, what is it that helps us engage when we probably feel that we don't want to engage?
Mm.
What is it that helps us feel part of community? And what is it about that membership space that really sits with that social identity theory?
Mm.
And it's that vicarious joining in. Mm. So not necessarily actually being present, as in, you can join something, but you don't have to have an image up.
Okay.
Or you can join quietly behind the scenes. And this idea that if we are given opportunities to be able to do that, vicarious joining in can be a platform or a step for some people to know whether, or to test on the outsides around, is this the right community for me? Is this how I feel? And we were talking very earlier about this juggle, or this kind of rhythm we have to get with things like Substack. What do we hold for our subscribers versus what do we give for free?
Mm.
And the giving for free stuff is almost the vicarious stuff.
Mm.
It allows people to kind of understand, is this me? Is this a we place rather than me place? Are these people like me? And that's the culture in your horticulture, I suppose.
Well, that's interesting.
I find it so fascinating.
Yeah, also send me the link to that so I can have a read.
Yeah, I will do. That was the imposter phenomenon research. I was very intrigued. Why is it that women who experience imposter phenomenon will join online memberships where you are essentially being visible? You know, so when it doesn't work so well. But the bits that are really fascinating and right on the edge of our knowledge are the things that you're attempting to do this year, which is, what happens if I take something that which is intrinsically very physical in person, but I'm going to subvert that.
It's funny, isn't it? I think like my brain is like, what? It's a bit like how I came up with the activities in the first place. It's like, well, what happens if I do this? Does it work? Does it not work?
Yeah.
And that's just the scientist in me. Like, I just like to tweak and innovate. I feel very fortunate that I, you know, I've kind of been able to marry those two sides, like that science with the creativity.
I love the fact that it kind of comes from this point of being a florist at a weekend, and also just how you, the serendipity of just like going up and saying, you know, have you got a job? And then you've then used that as a platform to get to where you are now. Just such a wonderful story. I think this is such a great start to the season where I'm talking about expect the unexpected.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure that anyone would have expected a scientist looking at bacteria.
Mm.
To do what you're doing.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think this is the thing. It's like, you know, life, one of the days where we picked our career at 18 and, you know, and stayed in it. There of course are a few people, doctors, nurses, you know, those kind of roles. But I think even in those roles, you know, times are changing. And I think people are becoming a bit more discerning about what they want out of life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know a number of people that are maybe going part-time in those roles and then starting something creative on the side because they realise there's that itch there that their current role kind of doesn't allow for them to. Everybody should obviously get in their garden because, you know, that's how we're going to change the world. And, you know, wouldn't...
I do think there are some major political figures that I would love to go up to right now and say, will you just go and spend... you know, a day in the garden, maybe even a month. In fact, spend the rest of your life in the garden
I think maybe some of those world leaders that we mention are potentially a bit of a lost cause, although I don't like to admit defeat, you know, but I think we need to do that more, because I want to get into some more corporate settings, because I think there's a lot that can be said for having horticultural therapy and therapeutic gardens in workplaces. Imagine if you stepped out to have your lunch in the summer and, you know, it's a beautiful therapeutic garden with loads of sensory plants, and there's one of your colleagues there, you know, doing a bit of deadheading or doing some watering, and then you go back to your desk afterwards and actually you're feeling far calmer and, you know, more connected with the world around you. There was a news article recently. It said something like the sickness bill in the UK is £5 billion, and largely that's down to mental health and stress. Yes, we can do things ourselves as you know, as individuals, but actually as a collective, what can we do? And it comes back to that social element that you were bringing in there about if a workplace says, right, you know, once a week for the next 8 weeks, you can sign up to these horticultural therapy sessions. You can go and create something beautiful with your colleagues. Interestingly, now they are more interested in their staff doing therapeutic activities or, you know, well-being activities in the working day, because I was sort of catching up.
It's where we place the burden, isn't it, on, you know, workplace well-being. For about a decade, the burden has been on the individual to do a course and do activities that make you feel better, to almost outweigh or mitigate the stress that workplaces are putting you through, which has been a bit unkind, really. And then where we're starting to see smaller shifts, although certainly not as big as they need to be because of budgets and obviously changes in DEI and certain things like that, means that, you know, staff are saying, no, I'm not going to spend my lunch hour learning. I can't do after school.
Yeah.
Or I don't want to do after school. So I think that's really interesting. The other thing about, I suppose, just doing activities during work is that it doesn't have to be instead of progress. And last year and the year before, I did this wonderful activity at Freshers' Fairs with Derby University. So I was supporting a programme of work around student experience. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to really speak to students, and we wanted to engage with them. And it's really difficult to speak to a student and get them to open up and chat to, well, certainly for me, I'm like a 45, 46 years old person who, you know, they're kind of thinking, this is all new to me. Perhaps they're the first generation in their family to have gone to a university. They don't know what to expect. And the most simplest thing that we found, and the most effective thing to get people to open up and chat, was to give them a pot, which was recycled plastic, give them a little bit of earth and give them some cress seeds and say, come and make some cress seed pots. And then we just chatted to them while they were doing it. And it comes back to, you know, that soft focus of attention you were talking about earlier. It's this idea that it's that attention's relaxing rather than disturbing in the way social media would be. You know, we tried to do things through questionnaires, through social media, through Facebook, through this and that. And we bombard people electronically, but face to face, hands in muck, having a bit of a laugh about whether we think it'll grow on their windowsill or it'll just die, you know, yeah. That gave us a bigger opportunity to have those deeper conversations.
See how powerful as a leader in a business to be able to have those really honest conversations with your team,
yeah,
about, you know, in a safe environment that is going to be facilitated by somebody who's going to, you know, be able to get people talking openly, honestly, you know, hold space for the feedback, and actually, you know, outcomes show that you're more productive after you've spent time in the garden. You're more creative, especially in a marketing role or something like that. You know, creativity is so, so important.
Yeah.
And, you know, I appreciate horticultural therapy is a little left field. People are like, oh, gardening, that's weird. Why don't I just book some executive coaching? And it's like, but actually sometimes if we take the left field option, that's when we get far more benefits, because I think when we take the pressure off of people, rather than being like, you need to improve your performance and let's get you some coaching so you can do better, earn more money, and actually we do something community based, that actually benefits the team as a whole, that's so much more powerful because you're collectively coming together. It's not that you're not doing well, let's improve you. It's like, how can we improve as a whole? And how can we elevate all of us? And everyone will have those individual roles to play. So yeah, that's kind of, like I said, that's what I want to focus on this year. So I just need to find a few places that will let me have it in. And then I'm hoping I can gather some data on that. But
I'm going to give you a nudge to listen, if you've already done, to an episode I recorded at the end of last year with Lucy Green. Her whole goal is about helping business owners like yourself get into corporates. Oh, and that's the goal. Yeah.
I think that sounds great.
Before we go.
Yeah.
I've got two very specific gardening questions that I just want. My aunt bought these really expensive garlic bulbs.
Yeah.
And she gifted me one of these at Christmas, which I can honestly say was the best Christmas gift ever. I've just popped it into ground in December. Am I going to kill this garlic?
Did she just give you, you know, like the whole bulb you get?
Yeah.
Did she give you the individual cloves?
No, she gave me a whole bulb. So I pulled it apart.
Cool.
Took the little cloves and I've popped them into some soil. They are in my greenhouse because it's currently, as we're recording this, it's January and it's snowy.
The only thing with garlic is sometimes they can get a bit fussy if it gets really wet. In fact, I literally have just contributed to an article on things you can sow now in the garden, and garlic was one of them. So if you live and do some of those little jobs in the colder months,
yeah,
then you haven't got to worry about them in the spring because they'll already be growing away in the ground.
And my second question is, I feel like every year I put snowdrop bulbs in the ground. I can't get snowdrops to go, so I don't know what's going on there. I get loads of bluebells. And
do you buy them dry or do you buy them in the green? Okay.
So is that, yeah.
Well, it's a bit of a con, actually, and it annoys me that places sell them dry because it's very well known that if you buy them in the green, so you would probably need to buy them to when snowdrop season, like January, Feb,
probably in a few more weeks, yeah.
Towards the end of Feb, once they'll send them to you. If you plant them then, they have a much, much better success rate.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so do that. It annoys me that they sell them dry because the success rate is appalling for them, really.
I am so pleased that all the people who nudged me went, get Kendall on your podcast. I've thought about gardening quite a few times, either on my blogs or as part of my podcast. I found this fascinating and I'm sure that my podcast listeners will. And I think it's such a wonderful start to the season in that question. I'll pop all of your details into the show notes. Even though it's currently January, I think this episode's going to go out in the start of spring.
Lots of lovely spring bulbs, hopefully. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Psychologically Speaking. Bye for now.